Buongiorno, siamo al sabato della Biennale, spero che vi stiate divertendo, che stia piacendo questa edizione 2022. Mentre sto parlando stanno arrivando ancora un pochino di persone, vi ringrazio di essere qua di sabato mattina per incontrare Helga Novotny. Noi abbiamo il ricordo del 2007 ancora stampato nella mente, no, non sto pensando alla crisi finanziaria che ha portato alla Lehman e nemmeno alla presentazione dell'iPhone. No, nel 2007 la cosa importante che è successa è stata la fondazione dell'ERC, dello European Research Council, che è stato fondato con Helga Novotny presidente. Ha cambiato il modo di finanziare la ricerca in Europa con una logica che non era legata a forme strumentali della ricerca, ma la curiosità, la capacità di tirar fuori le idee degli scienziati, dei ricercatori europei. Da allora sono successe un sacco di cose grazie allo ERC e ha cambiato non soltanto le possibilità dei ricercatori di portare avanti le loro idee, ma anche l'idea di scienza in Europa, un'idea secondo la quale, insomma, la scienza è di per sé un valore, indipendentemente poi dalle sue chiarissime e importantissime conseguenze e ricadute, come si suol dire. Helga Novotny ha scritto molti libri, è una persona che studia la scienza da un punto di vista umano, dal punto di vista delle scienze sociali, è perfettamente adeguata allo spirito della Biennale, dove, come sappiamo, il motto è tecnologia è umanità, oppure è umanità, insomma ditela come volete, ma fondamentalmente questo rapporto tra la tecnologia e l'umanità, la scienza e l'evoluzione della società. La tecnologia non è una realtà separata, la tecnologia è l'umanità. E questa tecnologia della quale parliamo oggi, l'intelligenza artificiale cosiddetta, ha delle conseguenze che non sono soltanto tecniche, non sono soltanto economiche, sono anche puramente culturali. E di questo ci parla perché la sua ultima ricerca si è condensata in un libro che in inglese suona in AI We Trust. E chi ha mai visto, insomma, quelli vecchi si ricorderanno che sui dollari c'è scritto In God We Trust, questo è In AI We Trust. Poi in italiano è stata tradotta con, diciamo, un piglio più teologico, Le macchine di Dio. Perché le macchine di Dio? Che cosa fanno queste, la macchina di Dio, questa AI, che cosa fa alla nostra umanità? È quello che ci racconterà Helga Novotny alla fine della sua lezione. Avremo modo di fare un po' di dialogo, di domande e vi auguro una buona lezione. Helga Novotny.
Good morning also from my side. I will speak in English as it was announced. It is the first time that I'm here at the Biennale, and I was able yesterday to walk a bit around and to listen to some of the discussions, and I very much enjoyed the spirit, because we have reached a point in the development of science and society where it is important to bring together the natural sciences, the social sciences, and the humanities. And this also must happen in Polytechniki and other universities. And I very much feel this spirit and I applaud it. Thank you, Luca, for this very kind introduction. And these are just the titles that Luca spoke about. And the way how the titles are translated also reminds us that a Google Translate, an automatic translation, is far away from capturing the cultural context that goes with it. And all the automatic translations are not good at capturing irony. or ambivalence. So let me start by saying, when we speak about AI, or when we use words like machine learning, deep learning, now we have to learn something new, emergent learning, namely that you give a task to an AI, and while it looks at and works with the data, in a very simple task, through the repetition and the additional data it is being fed, it also is able to learn something that emerges. So this means we are confronted with a fast-moving target. And the knowledge of yesterday will be superseded by the knowledge of today and tomorrow. And this is just one of the many examples that I want to remind you of, this acceleration in the development of this technology. This is a picture, one of many. I could have chosen many different pictures that comes with the prominence of large language models, which are models working with algorithms, of course, based on an enormous amount of data that can be texts or images or both. And this is taken from one of these models, DALL-E 2, which is a Google model. There are other models. And what it allows you to do is to take a picture like what you see on the left side, the famous, beautiful picture by Vermeer that you can admire when you go to the Netherlands, and to tell the machine, you know, put this picture into what the kitchen might have looked like. But you could also come up with another picture. You could say, put the girl with the pearl into a modern home, or give her a companion of those years, or you can play around with it. But of course, it raises a number of questions. Is this art, or is it just an imitation with variations? And these are questions, the kind of questions that accompany us with every new step in the development of this technology. The humans are nowhere to be seen here, but in order to do that, a human is necessary, and the human must do something that in technical language is called prompting. So you have to put the machine into a position that it knows what to look for, which words or which objects. So you have to say kitchen, 17th century, you have to say, you know, pots or whatever. And then it comes up with trials, and then you have to say yes or no. And what it also illustrates is what we can call the unreasonable efficiency of this method. The method is efficient, it works, but it does not understand what it does. And this is very important to remind us of again and again when we are confronted with one of these stunning things that these machines can do. We say, wow, they are intelligent, but it's not intelligence in the human sense. It's a very efficient way to work with data, to do what you prompt it for, but it does not understand. So working with technology raises a couple of questions that have been with us for some time. One of the questions, of course, is the trust in technology. And being here at a polytechnic, and I just wanted to remind you, I was very much reminded when I saw the date of the Politecnico in Torino, which coincides more or less with a wave of similar polytechnics that were founded in Europe, like my alma mater, the ETH Zurich, practically around the same time, the one in Milano, the one in Vienna, in Munich, etc. So there was this wave of polytechnics that were founded. And of course, the trust in technology was the basis for engineering, and engineering was the basis for industrialization of our societies that was gathering steam at an enormous pace during that time until the end of the last century. And engineers are taught, rightly so, that we can trust technology, that the technology does what you tell it to do, that it avoids errors, it needs to be maintained, it needs to be repaired. But nevertheless, engineers are taught that you build trust into technology. But with it also comes this idea, we humans are the masters of technology. We are the ones that have created it, and it has to do what we want it to do. But this is challenged again and again. And what I want to draw your attention to is, why do we trust in technology? A simple answer is, normally or usually, it works. That's the power of technology. It works. And even if it breaks down, even if there are errors, we have the trust it can be repaired, it can do better, and this is how our trust becomes confirmed by what technologies do. Compare it with trust that we have in humans, in other beings, or our trust in institutions. If you trust your friend or a good friend, and your friend disappoints you, your friend promises you something that is very important to you, and then does not keep the promise, you're very disappointed, and if it's a serious matter, you will lose trust in this person, and it will be a break in your friendship. And if it comes to institutions, all data that we have tells us that trust, especially in political institutions, is going down a bit everywhere in Europe. And then people turn away, and we have people who either leave completely and they go into one of these bubbles of conspiracy theories and fake news, or they become very angry and they vote for populist parties. That's a way how trust in institutions that is lost is being translated in the political sphere. And yet we see that we are living in very complex society. This complexity forces us towards higher level of trust into technologies. They are black boxes, and we need to trust them. If you have an electricity grid, a nuclear power plant, you have to trust up to a certain level, while at the same time, the trust in political institutions declines. And yet, you know, we cling to this quest for control. We want to be in control, and we nevertheless very often are faced also, control escapes us. And this is why we are grappling today with a number of key issues. Among them is the issue of surveillance, and here Shoshana Zuboff has written the classical work about it, Surveillance Capitalism, where she shows in detail how large corporations are using the data that we give in many ways voluntarily to the providers, to the large corporations, and how this helps to survey us, and to reach the point where many people have the feeling the AI knows me better than I do myself, because the corporation has so many data about our preferences, even about our emotions, our physical state of health with the Fitbands, etc., etc. So this is an issue, because on the other hand, we cling very dearly to our privacy. And during the pandemic, privacy became an issue when, after some initial problems, nevertheless, in Europe, there was available a tracing app that worked from a technological point of view. Yet it was not adopted because people were afraid once the government uses it, it will use it also after the pandemic, and we don't want it. So this is one of the issues that is with us, that will be with us. Another issue of course, has to do with the way how the social media is eroding the public sphere. I will not go into more detail here. And another issue is the growing inequality that we face in society. It's more than the digital divide, because we see this enormous concentration of economic power. You have followed Elon Musk buying Twitter and the mess he made in the 2 weeks after he appointed himself as the only board member. And this enormous concentration of economic power, of course, also translates into political power, into social power. So these are some of the issues we grapple with. And it has to do with the question, who is in control, and the illusion of control. So let us step back a little bit and ask the question, how did we get to where we are now? And there is a short-term answer and a long-term answer. The short-term answer is a very simple one. It is the convergence of different strands that come together. Namely, we have an unprecedented amount of computational power. Our computers are not only smaller, they are much more powerful than ever before. We have access and availability, again, of an enormous amount of data of different kind, to the extent that some people start to worry already, what are we going to do in the future with this huge amount of data that can be stored and stored and stored, but there are also limits to storage of data. And the third one is, of course, algorithms that become more sophisticated. So, and infrastructure, of course, which is necessary, that also use a lot of energy, and in time of energy crisis, this also becomes an issue. So that's the short-term answer. It's not just one trend, it's the convergence of these different trends. But then there is the more long-term answer. And it was Fernand Braudel, the historian, who spoke about the long durée, that we need to look back deeper into history. And I think one way of approaching it is to look back into history deeper, but we should also look further into the future. Now, going back into history, we don't have to go very, very far, only to the middle of the past century, around 1936, Alan Turing, with his famous breakthrough paper that laid the mathematical foundations of where we are today, which was followed then with the Manhattan Project, John von Neumann putting the first working computer at the service of the Manhattan Project to develop the bomb. And of course, you had to do lots of calculations. And the word calculator in those days was used for humans. A calculator was, and they were in the majority women who were working as calculators, doing the nitty-gritty mathematical calculations that were necessary for the building of the atomic bomb. And then, of course, the computer came in, and this was part of this story. But I find it interesting that at the same time, and this is, of course, connected to the bomb, we can say this was the beginning of the Anthropocene. The Anthropocene is a new geological era or epoch, depending how you where you place it, where we say in the history of the Earth, we have reached a point where humans have such a large impact on the Earth that we can speak about the new era that begins. And when you listen to young people today, the word and concept of Anthropocene is everywhere around it. Now, the geologists are the timekeepers, the scientific timekeepers of the history of the Earth. And therefore, it is up to the geologist to officially declare that a new era begins, namely the Anthropocene begins. And the geologists, they deal with rocks, mainly and sediments of lakes and other hard evidence. So they insist and they say, if you claim this is a new era, you have to come up with hard evidence. You know, where do you see it in the history of the Earth? And so people have come up with different ideas, but most likely the matter has not been settled as yet because geologists also take their time. Geology is a slow-moving process. They take their time. And the most likely hard evidence are the radioactive traces that were left after the first trials of atomic bombs underground. So you have this interesting combination within a short period of time of the beginning of the digital age, with a predecessor, of course, the mathematical work, the work building a computer, making it run, etc., and the beginning of the Anthropocene, where we left radioactive traces that were human-made and not natural radioactivity. So looking into the future, I think, and this is my take on it, we are on the verge of having entered a co-evolutionary process between humans and the machines they created. And you might want to think of the machines, especially the digital machines, as a kind of other species. And there is a beautiful quote by Leonardo da Vinci, who said, and I have to paraphrase it because I did not find the original, but I know it exists. Leonardo said, with the help of nature, humans will create an infinite number of other species. And I think the machines, the digital machines we have, we may want to look at them as another species. And co-evolution means two species are entangled, they co-evolve together, one takes something from the other and gives to the other, and of course, as always in evolution, the process is open-ended. Now, I find it always interesting why someone chooses a certain topic as a research challenge. And therefore, I want to say a little bit about my personal journey through, I call it my journey through Digiland, digital landscape. Now, as Luca mentioned, my background is in science and technology studies, which means I am studying professionally science and how the science system works, what scientists do and how they work, but also the relationship between science and society. So it's the impact of science on society, but there's also the reverse. Which kind of social structure lets certain technologies, certain kinds of science emerge and not others? And so I could not ignore what was going on. So I became interested to follow more closely what does this digitalization, this living together with this new species, if you want to accompany me in using this metaphor of a species, what does it do to us and what do we do to it and what does it do to also to our social relations, to us personally but also to us in our social relations and to society. So I started to read the literature, and much of the literature was written at haste, very superficially, very much trying to catch up with the latest developments, so to be out in publishing a little bit after it actually happened. And I found it disappointing in terms of what it told me. But I quickly found out that whatever was written, and I also went to conferences, talked to people, that there was a divide between the techno-utopias and people who believed in these techno-utopias and the dystopias. Now, yesterday in this very room here, Evgeny Morozov was also speaking about utopias, and he called it the false utopias of Silicon Valley, that is, it propagates the utopia, for instance, that it can be regulated, it will be regulated quickly, that it will provide the solutions to all our problems. And whether we call it false utopias or fake utopias, but there are also people that actually believe that there is a utopian future. And if you go back only a little while when the internet came around, the people who were working as designers, developing the internet, they really, at least for a short period of time, were convinced, now we have a technology that allows us to democratize. We can open up a new utopian world where we will have more equality. We know the dream did not last. So there are the utopias, be it fake utopias or real utopias, and of course the dystopian vision that the AI will soon overtake everything, that we will become the slavish appendices of a technology. And I was dissatisfied with this bifurcation because I was looking for the connections and some, you know, empirical ground to stand on. And I also tend to think that part of the kind of speculations that are thrown at us are deliberately or indeliberately distractions from what are our real problems, that some of these large companies want us to discuss, you know, about human intelligence and, you know, is it now the consciousness of an AI? We are far away to understand human consciousness. Let us not speak about the consciousness of a machine. But then people are preoccupied with these speculations, with an imaginary, collective imaginary, and we tend to overlook the real pressing problems that have to do with who is in control, what does crypto, the crypto world do to our democratic, to our democratic institutions, how can we empower citizens, and so on. So I had to find my way through this maze and labyrinth. So I came up to focus on the power of predictive algorithms. And I did so because of my previous long-standing interest in social time, and prediction has to do with the future. And I have always been interested in how does our concept of the future change, what does it do to the way how we experience the present? And right now, I speak also about living in a digital time machine. We are at a moment where, on the one hand, as William Gibson said some time ago, the future has already arrived, it's just unevenly distributed. So the future is here, it's unevenly distributed. It is in digital devices and other possibilities. Thank you so much. Thank you. But we also have the past intruding into the present. These days, we have these marvelous pictures that the James Webb Telescope sends to us. And every few weeks, you see new pictures from some far distant galaxies, or how galaxies will collide, etc. And of course, we have the impression that these are things that happen right now, millions of light years away. But we are looking into the past. It's not a present as we have it today, It's the past because the speed of light is relatively slow. And until it reaches us from these immense distances, it's the past, but it intrudes into the present, it becomes part of our present. And this is one of the reasons why the present seems so overloaded. And it's not only that we have no time to do the many things we want to do, it's overloaded. So this was one of the reasons why I thought predictive algorithm is a good topic for me. And the other topic was I wrote a book about the cunning of uncertainty, in Italian, L'astuzia dell'incertezza, where I tried to come up with encouraging people to cope with uncertainty, not to be afraid of uncertainty. And of course, if we turn towards the future, it is uncertain, it remains uncertain. So my take on predictive algorithm is a very straightforward one. In every human culture, people wanted to know what the future holds for them. People were eager to find out what is ahead of them. And so they practiced divination. The Chinese had their oracle bones. In other places, in Africa, the the shaman throws chicken bones. In Rome, you had the auspices looking into the bird flocks or into the entrails, and so on. And today, we no longer practice divination, although some people still read horoscopes. But by and large, we still have the same wish to know what the future holds for us. We write official reports, energy report for 2030, 40, etc. And yet, the predictive algorithms are a continuation of the things we used to do. But there are pitfalls when we start to believe too much into their predictions. They do wonderful things when it comes to scientific predictions. Mind you, this deep mind protein folding, which is really quite a feat. But when it comes to human behavior, we attribute too much agency to an AI, predictive AI. And when we start to believe what the AI predicts for us and we start to act accordingly, we risk to have self-fulfilling prophecies. And we also risk to fall back into a deterministic worldview where the future has already been set for us. And this is what I call the prediction paradox. We leverage AI to increase our control over the future and uncertainty, while at the same time the performativity of AI, the power it has to make us act the way it predicts, reduces our agency of the future. So if the future is uncertain, and it is uncertain because we as human beings a part of biological evolution. We are biological beings and thus part of the way how biological evolution continues. At the same time, we have invented something that is cultural evolution, science and technology foremost, which is overtaking biological evolution. So the future is open and there is no set goal. It keeps evolving. And if we forget that these predictive algorithms let us see further, but that they are and remain probabilities, then we take the risk of falling back into conferring our agency. And we therefore have to remind ourselves the future has no data as yet. The data we have are extrapolations from the past. Sometimes this is a very reasonable assumption, but it is always a probability and it is never an absolute certainty. So what is to be done, and this is my wrap up with many open questions, but nevertheless, we face the fact that AI reinforces and leads to a concentration of power. Already in previous changes, economists of innovation call it the techno-economic paradigm changes. So industrialization was one of these major techno-economic paradigm changes, where the economy changes in its nature, society changes radically in its nature. So, and they have looked at what happened in previous times and what is happening now. And what happened in previous times is also you have an enormous concentration of power. The winner takes all, and there are good reasons why this happens. And unless there is the political will and the political ability to regulate, this concentration remains. And in history, it's always interesting to look back to history. There was one major corporation, the East India Company, at the height of British rule, the British Empire, that was more powerful than the state. They even had their own army. And somehow, I think we have to be very watchful to see how we can curb the power of these of this concentration and what it brings with it. Then, of course, as a remedy, everyone turns towards ethics. And ethics is called upon, it's ubiquitous in documents, etc. Of course, we want ethics. We want ethical behavior everywhere. But it's much more difficult, and ethics is not a checklist. There was a study group at ETH Zurich that looked at the official ethical guidelines, about 100 documents, 50 of them from governments and 50 from them from major business organizations. They looked into their ethical guidelines. So, you know, what is it all about? And they found no consensus. Even the principles of ethics in these almost 100 documents were not, there was no consensus. Transparency came out a little bit over 50% as forerunner. Then there were others like beneficial AI, trustworthy AI, etc. So you had all kinds of ethical principles that were appealed to, but no real consensus, let alone how to implement it. So it's a difficult topic, how to implement it. And there are technological problems with it, and we have not really found a good way as yet how to put ethics into it. And if you look at ethical procedures, it's one way you can look at ethical outcomes. That's another way. Each one has its own problems. And yet, you know, we are all very clear. We need to curb the biases that come with data. We know each one of us has his or her own biases. The data are biased depending on the sources, depending on the quality, depending how they are processed. And nevertheless, you know, we want to do something against these biases and other forms of use and abuse. And then there is, of course, the need for and the difficulty for regulation. And here we have to acknowledge that all the digital technologies and AI have to be seen also in a geopolitical context. And there is the US on the one hand, where regulation, despite claims of Silicon Valley, is thought to hamper innovation, so you do not want to regulate because you think it will slow down innovation. And you have China on the other hand, where the state is in control of everything and surveillance is without any constraints in the hands of the state. and Europe is in the middle and trying to appeal to our European values. And the European Commission has come out with a series of legislative attempts. There is the Digital Market Act, the Digital Services Act, the Digital Governance Act, the Digital Act, and so on. And yet they all have to be implemented, and we will have to see how far we can get, because it is important to have good legislation, but we also have to see how they are being implemented, and you have to monitor implementation. Otherwise, it remains just an ideal piece of legislative intention, good intention that remains on paper. So I want to finish here because I want to leave time for discussion. I want to say thank you, and I want to leave this thought with you. It's the last sentence of my book in Italian, and my book also has a chapter that is entitled Future Needs Wisdom, because I thought maybe this is what is needed. So thank you very much for your attention.
Grazie Helga Novotny, lei comprende l'italiano, preferisce parlare in inglese, ma insomma è in grado di sentire le nostre domande in italiano, naturalmente chi vuole può farlo in inglese, non ci sono nessuna limitazione da questo punto di vista. Mi è sembrato uno discorso ricchissimo di punti di riferimento. Uno, volevo proprio un chiarimento, perché se noi diciamo di avere fiducia nella tecnologia perché funziona, è un po' più difficile dire che abbiamo fiducia nella scienza perché non si sa se funziona, se è densa di ipotesi, insomma, ha un altro tipo di statuto epistemologico. Ora, nella nostra società, che ha questa tendenza ad essere arrabbiata, sfiduciata nei confronti delle istituzioni, la tecnologia può darsi che funzioni, ma la scienza sicuramente si pone in un territorio di dibattito. Abbiamo vissuto 2 anni nel quale questo dibattito è stato particolarmente significativo. Lei come ne è uscita? Che cosa è cambiato nel suo modo di vedere la fiducia nei confronti della scienza durante questi 2 anni di lockdown, Covid, eccetera? C'è stato un cambiamento oppure semplicemente abbiamo visto che le posizioni nella società si sono divise, quelli che ci credono, quelli che non ci credono, come se fosse un'opinione?
I think there is something that scientists have not done well in the past years, even before the pandemic, and in their communication with society. Because very often what was communicated were beautiful results, the product of research. And this was a way to respond to the pressure on scientists about the usefulness of their work. I mean, after all, it is taxpayers' money. The whole way of measuring impact, tell us already in your research proposal what the outcome will be. So there were a number of structural reasons why the shift was so much on the product. But what was neglected was the process of doing research. And the process of doing research is uncertain. If you know already the result, you are applying knowledge that you already have in a specific context, which is great, But it is not the openness of the research project. This is why in the ERC, you know, we have insisted there are no milestones, there are no delivery points, because you go this uncertain road. And there is a very beautiful metaphor that François Jacob, the Nobel laureate, has once used. And he says there is the day light side of science and the night science. And in day science, everything has worked beautifully, and you can present to the world the findings that you have obtained. Wonderful. But there's the night side, and nobody sees the night side. And in the night side, your experiment does not work. You have to throw the results into the waste paper basket. You have to start afresh. You are frustrated. You go home in the morning, etc. And yet, it's the other side of the medal. In other words, this uncertainty has not been communicated well, nor to the society, nor to politicians. And politicians, when they ask scientists, you know, is this, whether it's the pandemic or a cancerous subject or whatever, they want to have a clear yes or no. Is this cancerous, yes or no? But every honest answer a scientist can give is yes under certain conditions or no under certain conditions. But politicians don't want to listen. What are the conditions? They are very bad at probabilities. Or, you know, you have a range of certainty that you can give them and a range of uncertainty. And this, you know, brings me back to communicating much more how a research actually works, the process of doing research. And it's not the miraculous scientific method. You cannot just pull it out of a bag and, you know, put it somewhere and it will work. You have to do it step by step, and it's different in every field. And this is, and the outcome is uncertain. On the other side, scientists thrive on this uncertainty because you want to move where no one else has moved as yet. So you get excited about
uncertainty is freedom, is openness. Sono le possibilità si aprono se siamo incerti, se siamo troppo sicuri, come dice nel finale del suo discorso, la società si chiude, diventa deterministica in qualche modo, perde libertà.
So allora, I think this is one of the lessons of the pandemic that I would say every scientist, you know, communicating with society to be much more focused on how does research actually process. What is the work of a researcher, this procedure where you have to go back, you have this uncertainty. How are you trying out your various options? How do you decide? How do you go on? But at the same time, convey some of the enthusiasm that drives you forward.
Supponendo che la scienza riesca a convincere le persone che la incertezza è bella ed è la strada per aprire le forme migliori, insomma, dell'evoluzione, allora potremmo insegnare anche ai politici di essere un po' più incerti, che forse conquisterebbero un po' più di legittimità. Ok, ma voi vi state preparando, se volete alzare una mano è il momento, eccola là, sono tre, prego, prima lì.
I will pose the question in English. So the thing that, as you were mentioning, there are a lot of pressures to be certain, okay? And it's not just, in my opinion, it's not just that the politicians are so blind not to see uncertainty, but that in general, it is required it is your job to show some determination and certainty in a time of uncertainty, okay? And when we look back at statistics, the leaders that people remember are the certain ones, and especially in times of war. They don't remember, unfortunately, the most shaken ones, even though science, unfortunately, doesn't work like that. But bearing this in mind, and the pressure that this is putting on democracy, as it was being mentioned before, it has been paralleled that whoever wins the war on AI is actually going to be the new global leader. What would that look like if it wasn't the West with all its problems?
You know, I prefer not to speak about the war of AI. I think one of the worst nightmares is really that we are moving towards autonomous weapons being deployed, because this is really a nightmare if human decisions are completely eliminated and you just program a war and no one can interfere, even if you would want to interfere and to stop a process that can no longer be called back. So this is something that is before our eyes, and just as in the past, you know, previous generations started disarmament talks, and scientists were at the forefront, Americans and Soviets, to try to get some kind of agreement. And I think we have to move again in this direction, because it's humanity, you know, it's all of us that are implicated by if this happens. So in a way, I prefer, you know, not to see it as the most imminent danger, but to see it as something that we have to clearly see in front of us, and we have to start thinking what can be done to forestall it coming.
Yeah. And some weapons were forbidden. I mean,
that's
some.
Right. That's right.
In some cases, yeah. Humanity decided yeah. that something has not to be done.
That's right.
And I'm coming from Brussels, so my question will be related to the European pieces of legislation you mentioned. Did you have a chance to read the Artificial Intelligence Act, and do you have any suggestions, since the European Parliament is still working on it and the Council as well? Because there was this proposal from the suggestion from the Parliament to implement fundamental rights impact assessment. You mentioned ethics. I would like to know from you if you think that an ethical impact assessment should be done as well, or do you think that could be too much, since, for example, other politicians think that self-assessment is not enough for several cases, so there should be a third-party assessment, and I don't know. Your tips on this, thanks.
Well, we are getting into a sort of legal philosophical discussion here. You know, what is a good law? But in general, I think one approach that was taken by Brussels legislation was a risk-based approach. And I think this is a very sound approach. In other words, you define risky zones and what is sort of in the green zone, what is an orange zone, what is in a red zone. And so in order to differentiate, risk does not equal risk. You have some risks that are very serious and you have other risks. And probably something similar should be done with the kind of we all appeal to ethical principles, but how is it being implemented? And it's very important to talk to actual, you know, the designers and developers, and they will tell you it's such a complicated architecture. You cannot just take out one algorithm and turn it into a benign or ethical algorithm. It does not work like this. You have to look for intervention points. Where are the intervention points? And this will differ according to domain. There's not one landscape of intervention points and you can pinpoint it. So, you know, I would only appeal not to over-regulate, because then, it will not fit the empirical reality. On the other hand, to take a differentiated approach. And one of the things that comes up again and again when you talk to a practitioner is they don't know what to do with explainability, for instance. Yeah, because if you take it seriously, you cannot explain what an algorithm does in a way that everyone can understand it, or even that your peers can understand it. Yeah? So why do you put in such a criteria if you know that technologically it cannot be done? So these are some of my answers, but it's really it's an ongoing discussion that is important. But I think it's good to talk also to people who work in industry. There, of course, you have the problem that much of it is private, and we have far too little in the public domain of the kind of knowledge we would need. And luckily, here in Europe, we still have technical universities. If you go to, I was a couple of years ago, I was in California, and the University of Berkeley, and people complained openly, we no longer get the professors. We need to teach our students because industry pays them so well that we no longer get professors. So, you know, the public that has a right to educate youngsters with the best knowledge available, and then these people, you know, are being bought off by private industry, and we leave it to private industry to discuss these things.
I think we are in Europe, we are privileged citizens somehow. I mean, when I see Elon Musk firing 50% of Twitter employees just on the basis of economic criteria, I feel in danger. What can happen if one day he will become president of the United States? So what can Europe can do?
He was born in South Africa. No way.
No way. But him or somebody that can repeat. What Europe can do, I mean, because of our culture, of our history, we have more safe feelings on what can be the right limit somehow. What can Europe can do more to defend citizenship against a power that has no limit in itself, because it's driven by economic criteria that can go higher and higher?
Well, I agree with you that compared to both to the US and China, Europe is in a privileged position, except that we are not in control of these large corporations. And we have difficulty even to get them to pay a minimal amount of taxes that they should pay while, you know, they earn their money here, and yet they don't pay the taxes they should pay. So this, of course, is our problem. On the other hand, I mean, what can be done? I think the Brussels legislation is a good way forward. The regulations have to, the Act, Governance Act, for instance, has to be translated into national law within 13 months, so by September next year. Also, Italy has to have its Governance Act as a Italian law. And it offers you opportunities because democracy is as strong as it is on the ground as it is in a parliament. And if people start to realize that, you know, privacy of data or the way how you govern public data, because the Governance Act is about public data only, you know, it requires a very responsible way of dealing with these data. And you need certain standards, you need a guarantee of quality, you need some kind of institutions that knows where the data are and how you can make them usable and interoperable and reusable, because data are not there for the sake of data only. We want to do something meaningful and useful with them.
Thank you. I saw a hand over there. Is still a hand or no? Here? There.
important for meeting from science and technology is very important ethical. What about you, for you, this part? Thanks.
Could you repeat, please? We didn't get the beginning and...
I want to ask about ethical for you, for it's very important for communication, science and technology, but one part is for ethical, different for science or technology. Glielo dico in italiano, che così almeno comprende meglio. Noi abbiamo bisogno che la parte scientifica comunichi con la tecnologia, però è fondamentale che proprio perché noi siamo esseri umani, che ci sia una componente etica. Cosa pensa lei e qual è la sua componente nel dibattito tra queste due componenti scientifiche in proposito? Grazie.
The relationship, the ethical relationship between technology and science. Is there a priority, an ethical priority, to think technology, and is it different from thinking science?
Well, I would say, you know, science is has to be open for what we don't know as yet. So you don't and you cannot foresee all the implications of it. Nevertheless, we have ethical principles. You have research integrity, the way how to conduct scientific research. You have something like responsibility. Many universities now have adopted a code of conduct of integrity research, responsible research. So we have ethical, you know, pillars and ethical guiding principles for science. And for technology, I mean, once we have the law, what you can do with technology, what not. We have some relatively weak, but we have some international agreements. But it's an ongoing process because it's this fast-moving target, both science and technology. So you have to always look what is happening on the ground and where do we have to also live up to our own ethical principles. And there's an individual responsibility, but there's also a collective and an institutional responsibility. And universities also have an institutional responsibility.
Allora, c'era una mano alzata qua e poi lì in mezzo. Prego.
Hi, Helga. So, yeah, Luigi Giuliani from Mindvolution, Canada. I'd like to know your point of view on singularity, how this will play in the future for essentially when human being becomes obsolete. So the government, science committees will have no more say in defining these safeguards, in defining the future of how we think, how we build these worlds, right? So it would have been interesting to understand how singularity would play in your session and understand how it would be modeled. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, singularity, as you know, and probably everyone else here, was a concept that was introduced by Ray Kurzweil, and he means the further point ahead in time, so an evolutionary perspective, that might be around 2042, where the capability of AI taken all together is superseding what humans can do. Now, this is a hypothesis, you know, it's a speculation. It might happen, I doubt it that it will happen for many reasons, but, you know, it is one of these projections. Every technology makes us look into the future as a huge projection screen. And it's our collective imagination of what might happen in the future. And of course, everyone is free to project their own future imaginations into it. It has repercussions on what we do today, because if you are convinced in 42, which is not so far, and for the youngsters, you will all be around when it happens, what does it do to you? How do you change your life if you know the singularity is going to happen? So these collective imaginaries react back on us. And for me, science is organized skepticism. And as a scientist, you should have doubts, but you follow an organized way of expressing your doubts, and you follow an organized way when you say, you know, my doubt has been confirmed or not confirmed one way or another. So from this point of view, I think I would rely on science to tell us and to see what will happen. But I would not be, I would not want to be, you know, taken hostage by such a prediction.
Okay. Due mani qui.
We are
going to finish our time, but of course I'm happy to hear you.
Europe and the European Commission has been mentioned in various answers you gave us. I ask you just a whole evaluation of the lawmaking of European Commission on digital rights and specific problems such as responsibility of platforms. What is the strength point and the weak point for you?
Well, I'm not really into the details of it. I follow it as part of, you know, what I think it's necessary to know. But all I can say is, compared to what happens in the US, you know, we are far advanced in having these kind of discussions. And as you also know, it's the Commission that makes a proposal, it's the Parliament that is involved in the final product. And the Parliament should, of course, have also repercussions and relations to what happens at national level. So we all should be involved in discussing these things. And in many cases, let me just end with this, because I think the pandemic has also shown to us how much more we could have done with the data that were available, but they were fragmented, they were not communicated. Everywhere, in every country in Europe, you had this fragmented health system. You had hospitals. Each hospital has its own data, but the data could not be compared from one hospital to the other hospital, because the categories were not right, the classification did not exist, the means of sharing it did not exist, etc., etc. And there were, in every country again, good scientific institutions and groups of people who could have done a lot more had the data been available at the time. So all the scientific advice that was given on the basis of very weak and shaky data. They tried to do the best that they could. And so this is one of the lessons. And when we discuss AI, it should not just be, you know, privacy, and everyone is pushing us to know everything about us. We should also see the potential of using, especially in the health system, you know, data that will allow us also to go beyond the pandemic. Comorbidity is one example, you know. If you have the data, you can say there's a certain likelihood that people with one disease will also get another disease. So this is why you speak about comorbidity. And so, and then you can, you know, do a lot to prevent that this becomes fatal for these people. So a lot can, positive things can be done with data. Of course, you have to guarantee privacy, etc. And I think in our discussions, we have to put this much more into the forefront so that this legislation makes sense to people. And then they say, this is something that we would like to have, and this is part of a good health system.
Last question over there.
Hello. Thank you very much. I just want to start from seeing technology as a religion, as you were mentioning, for trusting, belief, and divination. So thinking that historically religion has always shaped society at the end, right? It's determined the rules on which society built up, right? So who are the prize today, and how can we make them accountable about the way they are shaping the society as my impression is they are at least reluctant to take this accountability on the power they have on society, as no one ever questioned it, the power of religion on society. So it's a cultural thing, not only a regulation way to shape this new mindset. So how can we make the new price accountable for how they are impacting on society?
Well, I would give you two different kinds of answer. One really is to go the path of regulation, and this is a question of political power and political will. And unless these large corporations that own algorithms, that are black boxed, we have no idea what the algorithm is, what it actually does, except we see the outcome. There's no obligation to open it up, to know anything about it. So if you don't agree with the outcome, you know, what can you do in order to curb the influence of this? But this is a question of regulation, and you need to have the political power also to implement it, to monitor it, to have penalties. You know, what the law does, the law is a social technology. And in order for the law to work, you know, you need to follow up to the very end, and you have to do it in a fair and transparent way, according to the rules. And the other answer, of course, as with religion, I mean, you had doubts about religion from before the Enlightenment, during the Enlightenment, ever after. So, you know, people have to begin to see that technology is human-made. There are different actors, there are vested interests in keeping a technology doing, and we can see it in an everyday way, how it works with us. These predictive algorithms, by these clever people who work, who get well paid, you know, they work in these large corporations, but they have refined the way to make you want to see certain things that they want you to see, because it is in their interest. And their interest is a profit interest, but they want to keep you doing it. And this is why some of this becomes addictive. And they have seen through the psychological mechanisms that make youngsters, you know, wanting to do and get certain results. So this is known, but we have to wake up to it and say, wait a moment, you know, I don't want to be completely captured by it. I want to keep my own judgment, my own identity.
Yeah, that would be, in any case, interesting to see if regulation could come to start a lawsuit against priests if I don't go to paradise after having done exactly what they preached. But I don't know if that's a correct approach. Then, thank you very much for this discussion and for the public.